Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there and everything else that is going on over there. So many things going on. Daily articles. We've got new academies that are now open. You can sign up for them. You want to learn about faith and reason, that relationship? Sign up for that academy. It's available. You can watch all the conference videos. You can go over there and check out the events page. You got to see where Chad's going to be speaking. You know, you got to see if he's going to be near you, which happens more and more, Chad, nowadays, because you got that events page going on. You know, it doesn't necessarily isn't one of our events, but one of us is speaking somewhere. And I don't know if you've had this happen. Is people been looking at that events page and then signing up for certain churches or camps or whatever it is, and you know, coming on out. So you never know. Chad could be like down the street from you, speaking somewhere, and you wouldn't even know it. Unless you went over to the events page and said, hey, is there anybody from 1517 anywhere near me? Let's check it out. So go and take advantage of all that. We are in Nehemiah chapter 10. We are right around verse 32. Last episode, you know, we had some people decide that they were going to make a covenant. You know, hey, and we're not going to make any old covenant. We're going to sign this thing. For whatever reason, right before we started recording this, Chad and I were talking about treaties. You know, we were talking about some treaties that, you know, people made with the Native Americans back in the day, and how these treaties were not exactly covenants, we'll say. A lot of treaty breaking going on there. No one's taking these treaties seriously. This part, we didn't get into this last episode, but there is something weird about what's going on here. I think that you can miss this. There are some people, they're going to do the, you know, they got some obligations to this covenant and whatnot, but this was not like something that God said, here's what I need you to do, and then we can start over. What I want you to do is to write some stuff down, some promises, and then I'm going to need a whole mess of people to sign it, and then I'll accept that as a good faith document. And we can get this thing going. This does seem like, and you know, I don't want to read too much into it, but this does seem sort of like man's solution to things, as opposed to just hearing, believing. Yeah, you say, you know what, God, check this out. We're going to be very serious here, and they do some things that they don't really need to do. I think they do some things that God looks at it and is like, well, I'm not really asking you to do that, or I don't think this really applies to you. And it's some of this stuff that you see in the New Testament with the Pharisees, where they enact some laws to keep you from getting anywhere near breaking the law. And I understand the concern that the people have, the leaders have, like, we don't want to get anywhere near where our forefathers were. We don't want to repeat that stuff. But this is probably, surprise, surprise, by the way, this doesn't work. But this is probably not how that is accomplished. You should probably stick with talking about the goodness and mercy of God, because that might keep you close to him.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things about, especially these later biblical books, it's pretty easy to miss. Just because something is described as happening, even something very religious happening, does not necessarily mean that what happened was something that God wanted to happen or that God said should happen. Many times these are just prompted by the people's desire. And I'm not questioning their desire, but prompted by their desire to walk in the ways of the Torah. And sometimes the way this was accomplished was by, okay, taking a law that's from the Torah, but that was really no longer able to be followed in its literal sense because the situation had changed. I mean, centuries had passed, right?
Yeah.
And we all know that, I mean, you look at the laws, say, from the 19th century or the 18th century or the 16th century or whatever. Well, a lot of times those laws had to be changed, had to be updated, had to be modernized because situations change. Well, you had laws given to the Israelites by Moses, and they entered into the promised land. For instance, you had the Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, all these peoples, and there were various laws that were connected with them. Well, what happens when they're no longer around? I mean, so you just like see these laws as historically applicable, but no longer applicable to the here and now, or as we see happening here, do you take these laws and say, you know what? Let's just kind of adapt them and modernize them and even expand them to our current situation.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of what's happening in Ezra and Nehemiah is that. And to piggyback off what you were saying, that same thing continues. And this is what we see happening, especially with the building of the fence around the commandments. We have all of these, well, what at that time were oral traditions, oral laws of the Jews that were promulgated by people like the Pharisees. And these were, yeah, they were taking elements of the law and expanding it, modernizing it, and taking it beyond what was actually written to keep people from actually getting to the commandment and breaking it. So, I mean, it's a complicated process. And I understand, like I said, the motivation. I'm not saying there was a wrong motivation here. I'm saying, though, that don't take things like this treaty or other things like the whole breaking up of marriages that we talked about with Ezra. Don't take that just because it's in the Bible as if this was the thing to do. And God was like, rah, 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 in heaven when his people were doing this. It's just what the people were doing.
Yeah. Also, what ends up happening when you do this, it might have some effect that you're after, but the effect that it certainly won't have is it will not make you keep the law, because what this actually ends up doing is it distorts the law, because you get the more you do this, the further and further away you get from the heart of the law, right? So you start like, okay, I'm going to take the letter of the law right here, and I don't want to get anywhere near that, so we're going to outlaw this, four steps away. And that fourth step away probably has nothing to do with the intent of the original law, right? And so this is it doesn't help you actually obey the law, because it kind of at this point doesn't have much to do with the law.
Right, right. And it can easily take on, in the perception of people, a divine quality. Oh, well, you know, this thing that's four steps removed from God's actual law is a divine law. Well, no, it's a fence. Maybe it's the fourth fence out from the commandments.
Well, you can see this with the Sabbath. Like, you have the Sabbath day, and you get to the point by the time Jesus is around where there are those who will say, does your baby weigh 15 pounds? Don't pick them up on the Sabbath. Now, let me tell you, this is so far from the heart of the Sabbath. Like, it couldn't be, like, you're running in the opposite direction. Like, you've now, like, tried, you're like, I don't want to work. I think picking up my 15-pound baby on the Sabbath is work, so I'm not going to do that. And now you've broken the command to love your neighbor, because probably your baby needs you to pick them up, right? So, like, you've created a law to keep from breaking a law that probably makes you break a different law.
Oh, we see that all over the place with Jesus and healings on the Sabbath, right? Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons that he healed on the Sabbath. It was kind of an in-your-face.
Yes.
What's more important, this oral law that you've come up with, which prohibits healing on the Sabbath, which, of course, is nowhere in the Torah. God nowhere prohibits healing on the Sabbath. So which is more important, your oral law, this fence you built around it, or loving your neighbor and exemplifying that love by actually healing this person on the Sabbath? Yeah. So, I mean, don't we see this happening all the time, especially in legalistic circles, where love gets diminished and laws get elevated?
Yeah.
To where really what matters is keeping these laws, these principles, almost all of which are nothing more than what people have come up with. And again, I'm not questioning motivations, but we should always question fences around the law, because these fences are erected by people's opinions in order to, well, do whatever, control themselves, control other people. And what it leads to, this proliferation of laws leads to a life in which, yeah, you're surrounded by these prohibitions, most of which are man-made, and you can't, therefore, live in the freedom of the gospel.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're always wondering, am I doing enough? Am I avoiding enough to stay on God's good side?
Yeah.
That's a little preface to this, but it's important.
Yeah, that's why Jesus comes around and says, let me boil this back down for you. Love the Lord your God, love your neighbor as yourself. Let's reduce this down to these two things. I think if you do these two things, which of course, you know, you're not doing, but if you maybe just focus right here if you want to know what this is really all about.
Yeah, that's where we need to be. That's where the law is leading us. So we were introduced last week to, for instance, not giving our daughters to the peoples of the land or taking their daughters for our sons. That's verse 30. Verse 31 is the Sabbath day. You got Gentiles coming in on the Sabbath to sell stuff. And we're going to come back to this in the last chapter of Nehemiah. And so we're not going to buy from them. not going to buy from them on the Sabbath or a holy day. And we're also going to forego the crops on the sabbatical year. Now, verse 32 says, we also, so the people signing this treaty, this covenant, we also take upon ourselves the obligation to give yearly a third part of a shekel for the service of the house of God. Why would they need that? For the showbread, the regular grain offering, the regular the burnt offering, the Sabbaths, the new moons, the appointed feasts, the holy things, the sin offering to make atonement for Israel and for all the work of the house of God. Now, this is a great example, because nowhere in the Torah is there an obligation to give yearly a third part of a shekel for the service of the house of God. There is when there is a census taken. Yeah, there's money that's collected. You can read about that back in Exodus chapter 30. But what's happened here is they're coming up, and I'm not saying this is right or wrong, but they are obligating themselves and others to basically contribute this third part of a shekel in order to make sure that the temple has enough money in order to continue operations. So this would be basically like if your local congregation got together in a congregational meeting and said, you know what, we're going to make a pact with each other that choose a number, 2%, 5%, 10% of our income is going to go to the church to make sure that the pastors have a salary or that the teachers have a salary or that there's, you know, plenty of money for the upkeep of the building, charitable concerns, whatever it might be. And everyone is obligated to do this, even though it's not in the Bible anywhere. That's kind of what's going on here. Now, this is, we hear this same kind of discussion later on. This is what comes up in Matthew chapter 17. Remember that story when, you know, the people come to Peter and they say, hey, you know, does your teacher not pay the temple tax? That's what that scenario was talking about. Right, so it changed
Jesus,
over time.
So Jesus says, go fishing.
Yeah. Jesus says to Peter, well, you know, once you toss your hook in the water and the first fish you catch, open its mouth and there's your tax. I wish Jesus still did that. I mean, the taxes, I'd go fishing if Jesus would put some gold coins in the mouth of a fish I kept.
If there were gold coins in the mouth of fish, I would be, I'd have a lot more poles in my garage.
Yeah, I would too. Yeah. I'd be on the bank of the river quite a bit. But anyway, that's the background of this. So that's part of the obligations that they place on each other to make sure that there's plenty of money coming in for the servants of the house of God. And here's another thing. Verse 34, we the priests, Levites, people have likewise cast lots for the wood offering. Now, that's kind of interesting because the Bible never talks about, back in the Torah, never talks about a wood offering. Well, what's a wood offering? I mean, you got animal offerings, you got, you know, drink offerings. Well, the wood offerings are those that are to be brought to the house of God according to our fathers' houses at times appointed year by year to burn on the altar of the Lord our God as it is written on in the law. Now, this is a classic example of what we're talking about. There is a law which stipulates, I believe it's in Leviticus 6, there is a law which stipulates that the fire on the altar shall be kept burning. It shall not go out. Okay, so we have that. But nothing is said about how that's to be done. Presumably the Gibeonites and the other servants, you know, the hewers of wood and the drawers of water, they took care of that. Well, they're not around anymore. So now they come up with this system whereby we kind of divvy it up and they're responsible, various people, various families, various groups for bringing the quote-unquote wood offering to make sure that the altar has enough there. But again, it's not required in the laws of Moses. Nowhere does it say, hey, this is what we should do. This is just what they come up with. Now, verse 35 takes us 35 all the way through 37, basically is saying we're also going to bring the first fruits of the ground of every fruit tree year by year. And we're going to bring the firstborn of our sons and of our cattle. Of course, the firstborn of the humans would have been redeemed. You offer a sacrifice for them. That's kind of the background of what's happening with Jesus in Luke chapter 2. So you got the firstborn of sons and our cattle, firstborn of our dough, fruit, wine, oil. All of this we're going to bring to the priest as well as to the Levites. The Levites are scattered throughout the country, the small part of the country that the Israelites are still inhabiting. And so they're going to bring these in. And verse 38 says that when the Levites collect this in the towns, there's going to be a priest with them. And then what happens with the Levites is, so the people give the Levites this stuff. And then the Levites give a tithe of that tithe. So the Levites are collecting all this from the regular Israelites, and then as their tithes, and then the Levites take this, and then they take a tenth or a tithe of that, and they pass it on to the priest, in order that basically everything happening at the temple may continue to happen. Because, you know, this was a big operation, even though it was going to get even bigger as time went on. It was still a big operation. You got to provide sacrifices. You got lambs. You got oxen. You got doves. You got a lot of sacrifices. You got oil. You got wine. You have to have things to take care of the priests and the Levites and the singers and the musicians. So this is it's not a business. So don't think of it that way. But it is a large enough organization, let's say, at the temple to require quite a bit of income coming in.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine if you had all of the equivalent of this much stuff going on at your local church all day, every day, right? Yeah. I mean, you'd be like, we got to increase the staff here. This is nuts.
We have a budget meeting. We have to increase our budget from whatever it is to another 100,000 or whatever it might be. Yeah, it's a lot going on, and the only way all these things going on continue to go on is by the Israelites contributing. Because even though it does seem as if initially the Persian leadership were contributing some to kind of get this going, probably over time that dwindled. And so you're left with the necessity of providing everything that was needed for the sacrifices and for the upkeep of the temple. So this is the pact, the treaty, the covenant, call it what you want, that they made with each other. And maybe there were some other stipulations, but these are the ones that are spelled out for us. Some involve the Sabbath, some involve marriages, some involved the temple. Most of them involved the kind of the practicalities of the temple. So the people, I mean, to their credit, they are serious about not neglecting the house of God. They want to make sure not only that they get things started, but that once they do, it's able to continue, because this is the house of God. This is where Yahweh is worshipped, and this is his holy city, as we're going to hear in the next chapter. So they were wanting to make sure that nothing got in the way of the worship that was to take place, and that they all wanted to take place at the temple in Jerusalem. And I think we're ready to jump into the next chapter. Now, the next chapter is going to be very brief. Very brief in our coverage of it, let me put it that way. The chapter itself is, let's see, 36 verses. But it's one of these chapters that's pretty characteristic of books like Chronicles and books like Ezra and Nehemiah, where you have a whole lot of lists with a whole lot of people's names, various categories of the people. And a lot of this seems to be just included to make sure that there's a full representation of all those who are involved in this. Almost seems like almost an administrative type list. Okay, these are the people. This is where they lived. These are the tribes. We want to make sure that we get this down in writing, number one, to show who they were, and also then for posterity. So it's a concern to make sure for the historical record that we know who these people were, where they lived, which tribe they were, how many there were, in order that we can, number one, be appreciative of everything they did to make this possible, but also just to preserve their memory for future generations.
You have to remember, you're not in the book of Isaiah here, where you're writing down words from God and stuff. So this is a record, and it reads like that.
Right. And it reads like that, yes. So one of the first things that we hear in chapter 11, before all the names begin, is that there was a need to make sure that Jerusalem was sufficiently populated by people so as to be able to defend it. So it doesn't do any good to build a wall and to have a city if you don't have enough people there to defend it, or enough people there to make sure that the city is prosperous. And so what they do is they cast lots. And basically, there was a tithe of the people. One out of 10 were chosen by these lots to live in Jerusalem, the holy city. while 9 of 10 remained in the other towns. So however, I'm not sure how this worked, but they cast lots. And the way it turned out was that, yeah, 1 out of every 10 moved into Jerusalem. That was going to be their place. Everybody else lived in the villages around Jerusalem or in that region. So there was going to be enough people living there in order to defend Jerusalem, in order to make sure that the city continued to grow and to prosper. And then what begins to happen is, in the rest of the chapter, is you have a lot of names that are listed here. You have the sons of Judah and the sons of Benjamin listed there by name. You have the priests that are listed. You have the Levites that are listed, gatekeepers, overseers of the Levites. And then toward the end of the chapter, you hear about the villages and their fields and some of the people of Judah who lived in these villages, such as Kiriath Arba, and Beersheba, Ziklag, all these various places. And those are usually divided between two different groups, the people of Judah and the people of Benjamin. Because remember, most of the other 10 tribes either ended up being taken into exile or they were absorbed into the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. They basically fled south when the Assyrians destroyed the north, and they continued to live with the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. So even though, you know, remnants of people from the 10 tribes continued, the biggest tribes that were left were the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin. And that's chapter 11. Is that a record? Have we ever covered a chapter that quickly?
If it's not a record,
it's close.
I can't think of what. Is there some super short chapter that just has, you know,
30, two verses,
34 names in it or something?
yeah. So that's chapter 11. Now, chapter 12 is, at least the beginning part of chapter 12 is similar. We start out with more names. And the first list are the priests. So these are the priests and the Levites who came up with Zerubbabel. That takes us back to the first groups that are coming over after the Persians defeat the Babylonians. So these are the priests, Levites, who came with Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Yeshua. And then we have them listed there. Now, the number that's listed here, there's only 22 names. Either there were a couple of names that weren't listed, or maybe they were continuing to grow. But we do know that by the time of the first century, these were the 24 priestly divisions. So the way it worked in the first century, just for those who might not know, say you were a priest around the time of Jesus. Well, where'd you live? What'd you do? Well, likely you did not live in Jerusalem. You lived in Jericho, or you lived somewhere else, and you were in one of these 24 orders of priests that were divided up according to these families or these clans. And where you lived, you had your job or you had your land. You know, maybe you were a farmer, maybe you were whatever it might be, your vocation was. Well, then when your turn came up, when it was your orders, your division's turn, then you traveled to Jerusalem and you stayed there a couple of weeks. You did your duties, you know, whatever that might involve around the temple. You worked there. And then when your time was up, what'd you do? Well, you went back home. And that's the background, of course, of the parable of the Good Samaritan. The priest has finished his tour of duty in Jerusalem, and he's going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. And we know that Jericho was a big home for priests, so he's on his way back. He was one of the priests in one of these 24 orders who had done his time of service, and now he's going back to his home. And that's just the way it worked in the first century. So don't kind of get this picture of Jerusalem just being full of thousands of priests, and they're all kind of working 365 days a year at the temple. It did not work that way.
Yeah, and that particular priest really misses the whole point of ceremonial cleanliness, as he is like, ooh, potential corpse, but maybe not, could be alive. Not going to find out because don't want to be touching any dead things.
Not going to gamble on that. Yeah.
I think you've really missed the heart of the law on this one.
Yeah, that parable has a lot of messages, but that is definitely a a primary message when it comes to the priest and the Levite. Yeah. Yeah. When you're, when your concern for ritual purity trumps any move toward compassion, then you know you're getting things wrong.
You might have overfenced that law at that point.
Might have overfenced the law. Yeah. So that's verses 1-7. Verses 8 and 9 give us a list of the Levites, and some of these names are familiar from some of the other lists that we've encountered in Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, verse 10 is interesting because verse 10 is going to introduce us to the high priest family, at least to some of those who served over time. So we've got Yeshua, the father of Jehoiakim, Jehoiakim, the father of Elishab, Elishab, the father of Jehoiada, and so on and so forth. So this was basically father to son, and then that son grew up. He became a father, and then his son would take over the high priesthood. And that's the way that it was supposed to work. Now, one of the things that I think is worth pointing out is that it did not continue to work that way. So the way this was supposed to work, the way it was set up, is, of course, to Aaron. From Aaron, it went to his son, and then from his son to the grandson, great-grandson. It was a hereditary office, the high priesthood was. And at least at this point, in the time of Nehemiah, it does seem to still be functioning that way. It did not continue to do so. So if you know anything about the intertestamental period, in particular the time of the Maccabees, which began the middle of the second century, so we'll say the 160s BC. As soon as the Maccabees rebelled against their overlords, Greeks, Syrians, whatever you want to call them, and then eventually won their independence, then what began to happen is whoever the Maccabean ruler was at the time, he also served as high priest, which was not allowed by the Torah. You weren't supposed to be king and priest at the same time.
Only two guys, maybe one guy, depending on how you
allowed
view
to
it.
Do that. Yeah.
Jesus and Melchizedek. Is it two guys? Is it one guy? You have to go listen to our episode on that, and you can hear Chad and I disagree. But the point is, not just anyone.
Yes, not just anyone. Certainly not these Maccabean rulers. But that is what happened. And then it got even worse. So once the Romans came in, and they were able to annex Judea, basically take over after this about 100-year period of independence on the part of the Jews under the Maccabees. So once the Romans came in, then well, think about it. Who do the Romans want to be the high priest? Someone they can control, right? So they're not going to appoint someone who's super strong, very independent. No, they're going to appoint someone who is going to do what they want to be done. And so what you begin to have happening in the high priesthood is people are jockeying for position, or they're buying the priesthood. And that's so by the time you get to the first century, the high priesthood has been corrupted to the point of where it's a bought and sold office, or something, an office to which whoever's in charge in Rome is appointing people in order to make sure that they're able to control as much as they can the people under the influence of the high priest. So it's a gradual devolving of the high priesthood that we see over time. But at least in Nehemiah 12:10, we have a list of these high priests that are placed there. And then in verse 12 and following, basically we have more names, heads of fathers' houses, priests, and so on and so forth. So that takes us through verse 26. And I'm going to not say anything more about that unless something you want to add, Dan.
Nope.
Okay. So if you're still with us, if you're waiting in you know, anticipation for the example that is to come, well, that's where we are now. So we are finally, after all this time, going to dedicate the wall. So yeah. Most people, if they know anything about Nehemiah, they know that Nehemiah built the wall in Jerusalem. We oversaw the work. And, well, it's done. And what do you, you know, when you put a lot of work into something, and it takes some time, and it takes a lot of organization, and there's, you know, sacrifices that are made, and you finally get it done. Well, what are you going to do? Well, you celebrate. You dedicate whatever this object is, or this building is, that you've worked so hard to construct. And that's what's going to happen here with verse 27 and following.
Yeah, I think the one thing to say, I guess, about getting up to this dedication of the wall and them doing all of these, getting all these people organized and writing all this stuff down, the one takeaway from that is that probably didn't happen in an afternoon. So, like, what you got to think is that, like, as we've, like, breezed through all this, because it's a bunch of names about a bunch of people, you know, having to do a bunch of things and stuff, no doubt this took a little doing. And so the dedication of the wall is sort of this culmination, not just of course, the wall being done, but you have all these other things that have been set in place. I mean, it's almost like you're ready to put the key in the ignition of, like, restarting everything. Like, we've got all the things in place, and we've got the people in place, and everyone understands what their job is, and we've all made these, you know, these vows and these promises, and, like, we're going to, like, now let's do it. Now it's time to start the engine and get this thing running.
Yeah, and you got to, I mean, it's, granted, it's kind of overwhelming to have all these names and all these detailed things kind of thrown at us. But keep in mind, too, every single one of these names represents a real person who was really involved in this work, whether they were a builder, whether they were a priest, whether they were a Levite, whether they were a musician, you know, whether they were a guard at the temple, flesh and blood person is represented by that name that God was placing there to do that kind of work. You know, to make sure that those bricks were laid, to make sure that the trumpet was blown, to make sure the animal was sacrificed. So, yeah, thanks be to God that he used all of these people that are listed for us to bring us then to the point, like you say, where you put the key in the ignition and you're ready to go. So verse 27 says, at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they got these Levites in their places, and they brought them to Jerusalem to celebrate the dedication with gladness, thanksgiving, singing, cymbals, harps, and lyres. So this isn't to be kind of a silent march through the streets. It's not even going to be like a march through the streets with singing. It's going to be a celebration. You got to have music.
Got the whole band out there.
Got to get the band out there. I mean, this is a huge deal, and it's not somber. There's nothing somber about this. This is a joyous occasion. So you got to kind of picture a party atmosphere here. You got the band going, you got people singing, you got people marching, people are coming in from out of town. This is a big deal. So you got the sons of the singers, they gather together from the district around Jerusalem and from the villages, kind of it lists them there for us. Everybody is coming to Jerusalem. And the priests and the Levites, they make sure that everybody's ritually pure. They purify themselves, they purify the people. They even somehow, we're not told how, purified the gates and the wall. Maybe this involves sprinkling of water. We're just really not told. But anyway, they ritually bathed themselves. No doubt they washed their clothes. They made sure that they stayed ritually pure. They purified gates and walls.
They don't touch any bodies along the way as they as they traveled over there.
You're coming to Jerusalem, and there's, you know, a guy who's left half dead. Just, yeah.
Cross to the other side.
Keep walking.
Don't even get close to him.
We got a party to get to here, right? So what does Nehemiah do? Well, he says, I brought the leaders of Jerusalem. This is his first person singular. We're back to that now. Nehemiah speaking. I got all these guys together. And he says, I appointed two choirs. So what's going to happen is you're going to get two groups of people. Nehemiah is going to lead one of these, and Ezra is going to lead the other of them. And they're going to walk, they're going to process at times, it seems, on top of the wall, and then at other times, probably off the wall. We're not given enough details to be able to tell precisely what happened and where they went, but you got two bands, two groups celebrating. Ezra's leading one, Nehemiah's leading another. They're kind of going separate directions, one clockwise, one counterclockwise. And they're going to end up at the temple. So they're dedicating the wall, but they're going to end up at the temple. So one goes south to the dung gate, on the wall to the dung gate. And half of the leaders of Judah, and we have their names listed there, they go with them. They got the trumpets, they got the musical instruments of David, the man of God, as it says in verse 36. Of course, David is, when we first meet David, our first impression of him is that he's actually, he's a musician. I mean, before he's a soldier, Before he's all the other things he became, he's a musician.
He's a harpist. And because of that, he's really good with a slingshot.
Yeah, I mean, he's a multi-talented guy.
Yeah.
And a shepherd. Yeah. And a ladies' man. David was a man of many talents. But yeah, he's a music man. And of course, he's connected with almost half of the Psalms in one way or another. So you got David the music man, who we learn in Chronicles kind of set up this organization of the various Levitical choirs and this huge complex of singers. He organized that. So anyway, you got these two groups. Ezra's with one, Nehemiah's with the other. And the one that Nehemiah's with, they're going to go to the north. And he's got half the people with him. And then in verse 38, we have, you know, some of the places listed where they went: Tower of the Ovens, Broad Wall, Gate of Ephraim, Gate of Yeshana, Fish Gate, these various towers. But they culminate in verse 40 when both choirs give thanks to the Lord when they're standing in the house of God. Now, verse 43 is a great way to kind of wrap up this section, because it says, five different times, joy or rejoicing is mentioned. It says they offered great sacrifices that day and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. The women and children also rejoiced. And, in case you didn't catch it the first four times, the joy of Jerusalem was heard far away. A lot of happy people. You got to picture Jerusalem just kind of almost vibrating with the excitement of all the stuff going on. I mean, it's a huge deal for them, because this has been a long time coming, a lot of work, a lot of time of waiting for this to finally culminate in today. And I think it's also for them, just nationally, such a big deal because of everything they've gone through. I mean, this city was in rubble after the Babylonians came through, and it stayed like that for all those decades. Well, they finally came back. They finally got the temple rebuilt, but the wall was in ruins. So finally Nehemiah gets there and he gets everything organized, and they get the wall built, gets everything else organized with the priests, the Levites, and make this pact and everything. And so this is kind of the icing on the cake, if you will, for everything that has been going on. So I don't know what to compare it to, but for the Israelites anyway, this is a huge day, because it's as if now they can finally be at peace and be secure and feel like they're kind of at a state where they can actually be okay for a while, be safe, be worshiping, be with their families, be doing what the people of God are meant to do.
Yeah, the thing that's cool about this is that, you know, this about this rejoicing is that, why do you rejoice? You rejoice because God made them rejoice. Now, this isn't like forced rejoicing. It's not as though like, God is forcing everyone to rejoice now. It's that they're rejoicing because what God has done forces this response of joy and rejoicing, which is cool because, you know, if we did that much work, we might rejoice in what we've done. We might be like, why are you rejoicing? Well, obviously, look at what we did. We've really done something here. We should be really happy. We're very pleased with ourselves. But this is not what happens. They said that they're rejoicing because God has made them rejoice. And so there is this acknowledgement, while, of course, they did a lot of work, that this is God's work, that God is the one who has allowed this to happen, that he's the reason that this is the way it is.
Yeah, which is what praise and thanksgiving is all about anyway. We're acknowledging that all of this is you. All of this is a gift from you. You're the one who orchestrated all the events that allowed us to return from exile. You protected us. You've given us people like Nehemiah, people like Ezra. You've given us all these things. And the culmination of them is the construction of this wall around the holy city. So, yeah, it's a big thanksgiving to the God who is the giver of all good gifts. And I think we'll stop there. Now, we don't have much more to go. We're at the very end of Nehemiah 12, and there's only 13 chapters in Nehemiah. So, one more episode on Nehemiah, and then we've got a very, very interesting book coming up next, the Book of Esther. So
yeah,
almost ready to start something new.
Well, one way or another, Chad, we are going to wrap up Nehemiah next week. Will it be a longer episode? I don't know. We'll see how we do. But we are committed. We're going to get to the end of Nehemiah next week so we can get into, yeah, a book that feels like unlike anything that we've encountered thus far.
Yeah, very, very different kind of biblical book. It'll be fun, though. Looking forward to it.
Absolutely. All right, man. Well, I'll see you next week for the conclusion.
All right. We'll see you then.